This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We begin with a conversation about a conversation between the United Kingdom, recently departing the European Union after Brexit, and Australia, once upon a time a fervent member of the British Empire. But now, Gregory, a very good evening to you. This begins to tell the story of what you call Kanzuk. What is Kanzuk, and how does the handshake between the prime ministers lead toward Kanzuk? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, Kanzuk is the emerging understanding that Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom will start to come back together, bearing in mind that they were once the United Kingdom and the three major dominions, that is, colonies which were populated largely by Britain and became, in a sense, countries which were, after independence, did not revert to a native population. So the three dominions were working towards coming back together through initially free trade agreements, and Canada and the UK have a free trade agreement. Canada and Australia, with this latest move, the prime ministers agreed on the terms, in principle, on the terms of a new free trade agreement between Australia and the United Kingdom, which would not only give great economic benefits to both sides, but would also start the process of the returning to the free movement of peoples between the UK and Australia, so they could go and work in each other's countries, live in each other's countries and the like, bearing in mind that they have so much in common, as do all of the Kanzuk countries, a common legal system, common parliamentary system, a common head of state, common defence structures, a common approach and sharing of intelligence and the like. So this is a big deal. The Australia-UK agreement in principle between Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Prime Minister Scott Morrison actually, however, did not go as far as most people in Britain and Australia would have liked it to have gone. That's the interesting thing, that the governments are still lagging behind the public. Boris Johnson still hung up on if you like, being a European power. Yes, he knows he has to be a global player, and to do that, he needs Australia to get into the Pacific Trade Agreement. So basically, it's working towards that. But what most Australians and Brits would have liked was to have seen the acknowledgement that this was the resumption of a familial relationship, but now on a peer-to-peer basis, not on a United Kingdom as the primary power and the dominions as the lesser powers.
The conversation then has a long way to go, but is the emerging authority of Russia and China, recently identified in NATO, is that a driver for this for trade agreements? Does it lead to military alliances?
Well, yes, it does lead to a military alliance. There are already military alliances between Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom, the so-called ANZUC, Australia-New Zealand-UK military agreement. There's also the five-power defence arrangements, which also include, for example, Malaysia and Singapore and the United Kingdom and Australia. But it wasn't driven so much by the threat of China, if you like, but by the need for Britain, once it left the European Union, to return to its traditional role, which is as a global trading power, in order to be a viable advanced economy. It needs to resume world trade, which it gave up in basically 1972 when it went into the European Common Market. So now it has to get those markets back, and it needs to be a global player. That's why it needs global strategic projection as well. That's why it's sending its carrier task force out into the Indo-Pacific in the coming months. It's all about Britain resuming its role as a global trader, and it's that's the only option it has once it leaves the European Union.
Former member of the British Empire, at one point part of the conflict in the 19th century, Ethiopia. Ethiopia's elections, you report, are going to lead to significant changes for Ethiopia. We've discussed Ethiopia in terms of its plans, its ambitions to perhaps unite with Eritrea and form 120 million people a population of 120 million people, with Djibouti perhaps another piece. But what happens next after these elections that would move the process of uniting these large groups?
Well, of course, Ethiopia was never a British colony, although they've had a war together against Emperor Johannes in the 19th century. But it's now the 80th anniversary year of the Battle of Gondar, when the Ethiopian and British forces drove the Italians out of Ethiopia. That was the first Allied victory of World War II, the first time Axis forces had been kicked out of an occupied territory. So there's that familial relationship. But what we're concerned about now with Ethiopia, of course, are the elections, which have just been held on June 21st. And where is that going? Well, arguably, this was the sixth election since the coup and regicide of Emperor Haile Selassie in 1974. But this is the first one that's had any semblance of transparency and democratic process. So what we will see for the first time is that the new government will come in probably with about 60 or 70% of the seats, but not 100% of the seats or 120% of the vote, as one of the elections more or less had it in earlier years. So it looks like Prime Minister Abiy will be restored to office as Prime Minister. It will not be an easy ride for him because he will have an opposition for the first time. He will need to woo back certain regions, particularly the Amhara region, which he alienated by not stopping Oromo extremists and Tigrayan extremists for a while from actually engaging in genocidal policies and practices towards the Amhara people. So the Amhara went into this election very skeptical, and basically if the Amhara people don't support the new government, then that will be difficult for the Prime Minister, even though he might have the majority of seats in Parliament. So what we'll see him do, I think, once he takes over, is take a totally new look at the situation. He will, and he's promised to, give a major overhaul to the communist constitution of 1994, which is still in place, and which prohibits the private ownership of land. So that has to change if they're going to get any foreign investment. He will now look at that revived federation or confederation with Eritrea, bringing Eritrea back into the fold, and as you say, maybe down the line, Djibouti as well. He's going to have to not only woo back the Amhara people, but also the Tigrayan population. And we have to separate the Tigrayan population from that very fringe group called the TPLF, the Tigray Popular Liberation Front, which started the war last year. They were kicked out of office, or they actually fell out of office in 2018 when they could no longer govern. And then when they went out of office, they took their bat and ball and went home in a sulk. But they had about 30,000 militia trained by the United States Special Forces. They had massive amounts of arms. They'd stolen about $30 billion from the Treasury and from the aid programs. And so they're using that to wage war against the successor government. They are a Marxist organization, most definitely, but ironically, they are using some of their stolen billions, and with a lot of their senior officials having been given American passports, they've set up information offices in Washington, and they've basically colored the entire global press coverage of the civil war in Ethiopia, blaming this on the government. Now, the government may not have reacted as well as it could have, but basically this conflict and the horrific, genocidal acts of the TPLF was started by the TPLF. So that message still hasn't, if you like, got out into the global domain. And it's being supported because portraying Ethiopia as a bad actor at this stage suits Washington, the State Department, and the Foreign Commonwealth Office, for example, because they all want to maintain good relations with Egypt, and Egypt wants to see Ethiopia divided because Ethiopia controls the headwaters of the Blue Nile, which gives most of the water to the Nile, which flows into Egypt. So you've got this complex mix there, and Ethiopia is also being used as a playing ground for other players, like, for example, the Turks. Turkish intelligence there is going in and stirring up trouble. It's funding some of these Oromo and Tigrayan groups to literally just keep the pot boiling, if you like, the whole time. So it's going to be a very interesting time in the coming year. And 90% of it, in a sense, is going to be Abiy winning back the hearts and minds of Ethiopians and the international community. And if he's, you know, got the capability to strike a grand bargain with Egypt so that the Egyptian government of President el-Sisi and Ethiopia can come together in a win-win situation over the Nile.
Does Dr. Abiy have regional partners to deal to work with? You've mentioned Eritrea and Djibouti. What about in the Gulf? Yes. Does he have partners in the Gulf?
He has very strong and close connections with the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. So that is very helpful. Interestingly enough, the Iranian government has been sniffing around to make overtures as to whether they can befriend the government in Addis Ababa, given that Iran is aware that some of the Western powers have been listening to the hostile propaganda about Ethiopia. So, and of course, the People's Republic of China is trying to get back into the good graces of Ethiopia, bearing in mind that when Dr. Abiy took over, he basically kicked the People's Republic of China out of Ethiopia. And we recall that the current Director General of the World Health Organization is a former Tigrayan TPLF Marxist minister who became the Director General of the World Health Organization, and he is, of course, directly aligned with the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing.
Is it your measure that Cairo has the resources to press this war with using Somalia?
No. In fact, although the Egyptian government has been fighting with proxy forces, both Somali and Oromo, and going in through Somalia, and they've been attempting to go in through Somaliland as well, the former British Somaliland up around Berbera and the like. The reality is that the Egyptians know that they could, yes, make some damaging and embarrassing military strikes on Ethiopia. They probably couldn't even destroy the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which is the alleged problem between the countries. It's a war they can't win. Now, bear in mind, Egypt has gone to war with Ethiopia on numerous occasions, particularly in the 19th century, when Empress Johannes was there and Emperor Menelik and the like, and they failed. That was, of course, the Egyptian monarchical government then literally run by the Ottomans.
I'm speaking with Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We're going to go across the Gulf when we come back to Iran following the election of a man who's known as the Hanging Judge, Raisi. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.